But right now on the phone, I have our good friend Sonny Osborne. So, Sonny, you want to say hello?
Hey, how's it going?
How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
All right. Now, did you watch the UK game or just tape it? Because I don't want to talk about it if you haven't seen it.
Oh, I know the outcome.
Okay, I don't, but tell me, because then I won't have to track down ESPN later.
Are you sure let me tell you?
Yeah, man, go ahead. I'm not going to watch it. I don't have it taped. I was watching part of it, and I started the show at 2, and I just figured you could tell me when you came on the air.
They got beat.
Did they really?
64 or 55.
I'll be darned. Well, Baylor was an experienced team, so.
Yeah, they're made up of juniors, seniors, and, you know, some guys are Kentucky. They're just too young yet, and,
Seems like they have bad hands, doesn't it? Seems like they drop the ball a lot, or like they don't seem to be able to control the ball that much. I don't know how to explain it. But
they don't have a true point guard.
That's it.
And that really hurts because you've got to have a good point guard. And like last year, that little guy, he made the team last year as a point guard. And,
well,
that Poulsen boy, who's a walk-on, is playing better than the one he recruited, I think. Of course, I've never seen that Harold, whatever his name is. I've never seen him play yet.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. They need a point guard who's going to take over the game for that dribble drive, and then they got to tighten up their defense. But they're awful young.
They need that. They need it bad, and they won't ever do any good until they get one.
Right, right. Casey.
Either this year when one of those guys learn, or next year, whenever, that team won't be worth much without a point guard, I don't think.
Yeah.
The whole thing revolves around a good point guard.
I agree with you. And just for the people that are tuning in to Worldwide Bluegrass, Sonny and I have this option. Every time we start, we can talk about UK basketball as much as we want to, and that's what we're doing right now. So we're
both.
Yeah, man. The Wildcats, it goes back. It's in your blood if you're from the state, and there's just nothing you can do about it. It's just in your blood.
Not a thing.
Hey, I was thinking. You feeling okay today then, huh?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I can't complain too much.
Well,
sometimes they don't say I'm afraid to complain, afraid it'll get worse.
I think last week, and we were talking before you came on the air, last week we had some fun. We patched in Bill Evans from California and you at the same time. And, I thought that worked really fine. And I know Bill will do it again sometime. And, hopefully we can set up some more three ways. And I think when JD Crow finally pulls the plug and isn't as busy, I had talked to him about a month ago that he'd be happy to call in. I'm thinking now we'll connect you and JD and me, and I'll shut up and you all can talk about stuff for a while.
Yeah. JD's a hard guy to get in touch with. He's just a hard guy to get in touch with. That's all there is to it.
Well,
sometimes you can't.
That's right. When I called about a month ago, I got him, and I called him at his home, and I just couldn't catch him this week, but I thought we'll get a hold of him and set up a three-way conversation. You know, that'll be fun.
JD's a good guy.
Oh, yeah.
Very good guy.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I sent you a message the other day, and throughout these conversations we've had, we've talked about a lot of things, and we've hit upon your banjo camp a couple times, and never really talked about it in detail. But I went to the very first one, and I must have drank some special Kool-Aid because I've been back every one since then. But I enjoyed so much, and then right before we came on, I thought, well, maybe I would ask Sonny. And sometimes people say, who are you talking to on the phone? I'm talking to Sonny Osborne. Sometimes they want a reminder of that. But I thought I'd ask you about what you can remember about how and why this thing got started.
Well, Cindy Sinclair does, they call it Nat Camp. And it's like country. She has country, and she used to do three or four of them a year. And so Bill Evans and had contacted me, if I remember this right, contacted me and asked if I'd like to do banjo camp in the fall. And of course, I'm right here with nothing to do. I said, "Yeah, I'll be glad to." I think our first one was 2001, and really worked well. We did it at a place called the Trouillard House here in about 50 miles from Nashville. And, it was just outstanding. Pete Warney, Bill Evans and I, and then I think, if I remember right, we had Alan Mundy and, Ned Labrecki.
No, Ned was there, but Alan wasn't until a year after that.
Okay.
Tony was later. Let me ask you this. Did you know Ned before that first banjo camp?
Did I do what?
Did you know Ned Labrecki before that first camp?
No, I did not.
Yeah.
I never realized what a talented man that is. And he is a very, very talented guy. Funny, and he can play anything, anyway. And he's just a very talented guy. I think John Hartford did a song called the, is the Washing Machine Boogie?
That's called, I know what it's called. It's, oh, wait a minute. It's like, Hey Baby, Want a Boogie or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's Washing Machine Boogie.
Okay.
And he does that like John did, but then the son of the gun turns around and he'll do it backwards. And it is funny. I mean, I've seen people laugh so hard they cry over the way he sounds when he does that. It is really funny. He makes the noise of the washing machine, and it's funny. It's really funny. But Ned is a very talented man.
Well, and, you know, it just gives you an idea of what his hearing, what his ear is like. Because if you record that, matter of fact, he did an album where he did it backwards and then played it, that version backwards onto the same record, and he's singing it straightforward. It's not just that he says the words backwards. He makes all the sounds backwards so that when you play it forward, well, he's actually singing the words.
He learned it that way. He really did. And I don't see how. I do not see how he did that, but he did. And he's just a very talented guy. Well, anyway, Bill and Cindy and me and Pete Warnick, we did the first one. And the year after that, Pete had a thing he was doing in England, and he couldn't make it, and so we didn't particularly like that too much. And Pete hadn't been back since, which is kind of funny in a way. But we've had old Bill Emerson, J.D. Crowe, Rob McCurry was there, has been there. Of course, Tony Trischka.
Jimmy Mills.
Ron Block.
Ronnie McCory, Charlie Cushman, you mentioned him. Kristen Scott Benson comes up like every other year. Tony Trischka.
Kristen and Tony Trischka and Alan Mundy.
Alan Mundy.
And Charlie Cushman was there. And,
Jens Kruger.
It's a good thing. Really good thing.
Oh, yeah. And Jens Kruger came twice, once by himself and once with his brother and their bass player.
Yeah, he was there by himself one time, and he talked us into hiring the whole band, which the whole band consists of his brother and the bass player.
Yeah.
And Joel. And it's just, we've seen some mighty talented people. Oh. I mean, really some good, talented banjo players, and Kruger, I guess, surprised everybody probably more than anybody else, because I had no idea that he was as good as he is, and that guy is something else. He is really something else, and it was a pleasure, and he's a good guy on top of that, too. But I don't know if you realize, but Kruger, Jens Kruger, and a lot of people in term might not understand exactly who he is, but he lives in North Carolina, and I think they're from Switzerland.
Yeah.
I think.
Right.
And he and his brother and this bass player named Joel, I never did know his last name, Joel something, and they play wonderful music. I mean, really, it's beyond my realm of understanding. And but they're awfully good.
Well, and you can't put it in a category. I mean, it's just wherever they want to go, they go there. And the bass player Joel, and I'm with you. I can't remember his last name. He goes wherever they go, and they just go wherever they feel like going at a level of musicianship that is just stunning. I mean, it really is.
It really is. I don't know if you know this, but they, every day that they don't work, every day, like at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, they get together and they play, rehearse, they play over and over and over again, every day, like for 3 or 4 or 5 hours, every day. And that's why they can play anything, and they all know what the other one's going to do. And it is, it's a fun thing to watch. I don't think I could pull my interest long enough to, at this age, to practice that much. I imagine Jens is probably in his 40s, mid-40s, and Uwe is the same way, his brother. And they're all about the same age, I guess. They live in North Carolina. And, well, they work at it. They really do. And it shows you what practice will actually do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hey, you want to do something? Hey, let me do something fun. We've kidded about, Ned's version of John Hartford tune. I have that queued up. Can I go back and just play that for people listening and trying to figure out what the heck we were talking about? Then we'll get back on Banjo Camp. Can I do that for 5 minutes?
Sure. Go ahead.
All right. Let's do that, because they're probably scratching their head. And folks, you're not going to believe, and don't think your radio is possessed or anything bizarre is going on, but this is from the mind of Ned Lubarecki, who we were just talking about. And what you're going to hear as a setup is Ned does John Hartford's Boogie Woogie song backwards phonetically. And then I believe on the same cut, he'll play it forwards. And he's recorded the backwards version and playing it forwards. This will blow your mind. Hold on. This is unreal for sure. Hold on a second, Sonny. I'll get back with you.
Yeah.
All right, we're back live again in the studio, as it were, which is my house. And that was Ned Lubarecki. Sonny, we were just talking about that, and I thought, well, I'll throw that out to people. And I'll tell you this, I played that one time without any real introduction, and there were people that went running from the chat room and never returned because of all that backward stuff that Ned does. And I just thought, well, if you'll stick around long enough, you'll figure out what's going on. But I kind of dropped it in the playlist without an introduction, and there were some people that ran away and never did return, but I just think that's brilliant. And I don't know how Ned can, we talked about that off the air. He's got that ability to hear things and they stick in his head, and he hears it backwards and he can sing it backwards, and you play it forwards and it's forwards, and just, but he does that live, and I've seen him do it like you have. And every time I see it, I think, this can't be real. There must be something wrong with this picture. And that's, so we just played that for them, which was fun.
That's absolutely unreal. Unreal. But anyway, the Banjo Camp, we have about 60, 65 people come from all over, California, Maine, all over. They come down there and they spend a Thursday, or actually Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But then on Thursday they have a thing at the Station Inn here in Nashville where all the artists, the teachers, I guess you want to call them, they get on stage at the Station Inn, and then I guess they let other people get up there and play too. But it's just a fun thing. And then on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they have classes for beginners, intermediate, and for advanced students. And if you're an advanced banjo player, I mean a good banjo player, we got guys that can show you how to do things a little better, a little different, and it's a learning experience. It really is.
Well, I mean, imagine for somebody, and I did. I had got back into playing. I'd been out forever and ever and ever, and I got back into playing the summer before your first camp, and I thought this will be a good kickoff for me. And imagine sitting in a room with the likes of over the years, And right up close and personal. First of all, with you, which was like, you know, unthinkable at the time. And now you've become my friend, which is great. But imagine sitting in a room and you want to learn banjos, and you're sitting in a room like one chair away from Tony Trischka and Ned and Pete Wernick and Charlie Cushman and Jimmy Mills and Chris. I mean, it's the most unbelievable thing. I don't think I'll miss it unless, you know, my car breaks down. I don't plan on missing it, but it's just an amazing experience.
We'll send the car after you.
Only if you come and get me in that Prius, I'll come down if I got a broken car. Cause I want to see 52 miles an hour. I want to see 52 miles per gallon on the expressway.
Well, it'll do it. I know. If you get just right and drive it right, you can get 54, 55 miles a gallon in that little car. It's amazing. It's truly, absolutely amazing. To me, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said,
those people that charge on the flag for gasoline or oil, I guess you would call it, that's the only way you can beat them, the way I look at it.
Yeah.
Is it the car that'll get, if they'll just keep on working at it, they'll get one that'll do 100 miles a gallon. And if they will keep on doing that, then that's the way to beat them. But I heard, you know what I heard on the news, I think about a week ago, that by 2020, the United States will be the largest oil-producing country in the world.
Really?
And if that be the case, I don't know why we can't do it right now.
Well, you're right. You're right. If it's there to get, I don't, these are big questions. These questions are beyond the scope, as I would say in the courtroom. This is beyond the scope of the direct examination, what you're going into right now. I just can't handle these. I appreciate your thoughts on it, but these are beyond the scope of what we've got here in the next 20 minutes. So we'll do a show called worldwidequestionsofalltime.com, and then we'll get on and we'll talk about oil and all those bigger questions.
They talked about that quite a while, that by that time, we'll be the largest oil-producing country in the world, and if that be the case, what's the holdup? Why not lease it right now?
These are mysteries, Sonny. That's all I can tell you. These come under the classifications of mysteries.
Well, it comes under the classification of politicians.
Same thing. That's a subclass of mystery. That's a subclass of mystery.
Politicians and money. That's the whole thing.
So the banjo camp, and it's been what, 11? Has it been 11 years, I guess? Then this was the 11th one.
This was our 11th. Yeah. And, I keep trying to go over highlights of the whole thing. And, Jens Kruger, I don't know what he calls it. I seem like he calls himself Jen, but I can't remember that. But anyway, it's spelled J-E-N-S, Kruger. And he was a major highlight. Kristen Henson, who has won Banjo Player of the Year 4 out of the last 5, and this year she was as the finalist. And, Sammy Sheeler won it. And, the way she goes about teaching was really good. I think about that. And Bill Emerson, how clean, he plays and what a relaxed gentleman that he actually is. And, Ron Block, he plays so well. Jimmy Mills. I get to thinking about all those guys. But, of course, Tony. And Tony Triska and Alan Mundy and how well versed they are on playing the banjo. They are just, Triska's unbelievable. He is so good. But those guys, I mean, they really stand out. And how well, like Cindy, does all the business things. She sets everything up and sends the tickets out and all that stuff. Cindy, irreplaceable. Bill Evans is a great teacher. He understands all parts of the banjo and can play just about any way you want to. He has this one-man show that he does that is I can't remember what he calls it. But anyway, it follows the history of the banjo from the time it started all the way through to now. And he has these instruments, different instruments that go back to those time periods.
I think he calls that banjo in America.
Is that what it is?
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Well, it's awfully good. I don't know that much. Not the only guy, but a guy that we would like to get is Bill Keith. Bill's an icon. And I don't necessarily, we've been into this, and talked about this.
I know.
Bill Evans, right? And Cindy, about that the majority of people want to hear just straight ahead banjo playing. And it seemed like that when we have a jam sessions, like after, like in the evening, after the classes are over, then the teachers sit around and they jam with people and have these major jam sessions. And the majority of them play melodic, I guess you call that. Is that what it's called?
I think so, yes. And they all kind of switch off, but I think they can all do what we would call melodic as opposed to that. You know, I never knew the difference, Sonny, between melodic and chromatic. Honestly, it was a lot of notes.
A lot of notes that I truly don't understand because I never played that way. But, and Bill Keith is probably, well, I think before he died, Bobby Thompson was the best at that I ever heard.
Oh, yeah.
He was so very good. And Bobby Thompson did so much for the banjo that it's unreal. He really did. Because he was here in town, and this is where all the music, this from Music City got its name, is because there was so much recording done here in this town. And Bobby Thompson was here and could play so well, and he was on so many records. I mean, every time that you heard a banjo, for ages, it was Bobby Thompson. And Bill Keith is probably, I don't think he was the first guy to do that kind of playing, but he's the best known, I think, guy that did that kind of playing. And
I think where Bill got a leg up, and I agree with you, Bobby, and by the way, a lot of people won't remember Bobby Thompson. I mean, you do, I do, because of the banjo. We're focused on banjos, but if you remember the hee-haw guy who wore the hat and kind of stood in the back, that was Bobby Thompson. Yeah. And then the opening theme to hee-haw, that was Bobby Thompson. That run where it kicked off, that was Bobby. Yeah. He was amazing.
You know what? I've come to think of that hee-haw. I made the first theme that they used for that.
Did you?
I had forgotten that.
Really?
I sure did, yeah. The first one, and then they had a different song, and they used it. They wrote a better song, and they used it.
Oh.
That hee-haw thing. But,
hey, you know, just talking about hee-haw, Ronnie Stoneman's going to call in next Saturday. It'll be long before you're on. I just want to talk about the Stoneman family band, and she makes me think about that little hee-haw gig also.
Ronnie is an interesting banjo player.
Yeah, well, and the life she led with that family band and all the stuff she's done is just, that's just a neat story, I think. And yeah, you're right, she's an interesting player.
Yeah, she's an interesting person, sure.
Yeah, anyway, I didn't want to sidetrack. We were talking about Bobby Thompson and Bill Keith. What I remember is they both kind of hit around the same time. And what I was going to say is I think Bill Keith got a leg up because he sat with Earl and wrote that book that guys like me learned from.
Yeah, I think before that, though, that what made Bill Keith famous was the first really good record that was made by Bill Monroe of the Sailor's Hornpipe. I think Keith was on that.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of propelled him into the limelight a great deal, more than Bobby Thompson. Although, I really believe that Thompson played that style first. I think he actually did. And, but it was just like Earl and Smith Hammett or Snuffy Jenkins, you know. What difference does it make who played it first? It got played and done, and that's all there was to it. So.
Well, then Bill invented those tuners that we all use to play that stuff. One version, you know.
Well, in the beginning, it was a guy named Danny Bump, B-U-M-P. I really think that Danny is the guy that came up with the idea for the Keith tuner, D tuners, and then. Keith, I think, probably invested some money or something into it, and he got his name in there with it, and then they got Earl involved in it too, later on, because Keith tuners have been around a long time, the D tuners, and he has also regular tuners now too. The regular tuners are just about as good as you can get. They're very good. I mean, they really are.
And for the people out there, again, and I sometimes forget to do this, Sonny Osborne and I are talking right now about detuners, and the song I think of most, that most people would recognize right away, that sound in, you know, either Earl's Breakdown or Flint Hill Special or Randy Lynn Rag, where everything goes out of tune and comes right back. It was, I guess Earl did that originally just by hand, right, Sonny? And then the tuners came about?
He did Earl's Breakdown. And he just used the regular tuner. And then, they came up with the, I think Flint Hill Special made them next. And he had his thing together then. And that was, oh man, that was so good. It really was good.
And what, was he using cam tuners on that? Probably.
That's what it was. It's like a push-pull situation to where this, when the thing is turned all the way clockwise, it has an arm that comes up and pushes the string up, and that raises it up to G. And when you turn it the other way around, it brings that arm down and lets the string go back down to D. And you got stops in there. I mean, you can adjust the stops in it. That's good. I have a tuner that I use. It's called the Ugly Tuner. And it's just like it says, they're ugly. They really are. But mine work perfectly. Every time, and once you get them set, they will be there forever until you move them. They're very good tuners.
Well, and I've tried both of them, and to the extent that I need them. Once you set yours up, they're done, man. You can change strings, and they're still ready. They might need a little tweaking, but even then they don't.
The only hang up that I had with the Keith tuners is the fact that, when you run the Keith tuners take the place of the second and third string tuner, regular tuners. And, they have little screws in there for stops. And, the only problem that I have with the Keith tuner is that when you run it up and back down, you have to reset them. It became a headache to me, anyway. And the ones that I've got, you don't have to reset them. I mean, they're always, they stay right where you put them.
The other advantage, too, is if you want to, I know you've written a couple songs to take advantage of them, you can flip them both at the same time and drop both of those strings down.
Oh yeah, mine work on levers. You can use them both at the same time. I had a lot of tunes where I would do that, and it's an interesting sound, very interesting sound. And I enjoy doing stuff like that, but it's kind of monotonous after a while, after you do it for a while.
Just in case, you know, and I'm learning this more from the conversation with you and Bill last week. There's some people that I assume a lot of knowledge when they tune in to hear you call in, but maybe they've never heard Flint Hill Special. Now that we've talked about the tuners, give me about 2 minutes and a half, and I'm going to play, and you and I'll just go off the air for a second, And I'm going to drop in their Flint Hill special from Flat and Scruggs, just so they kind of know that sound we're talking about. How's that work for you? Is that all right?
Yeah, that'll work fine. Let's do it right now.
Let's do that, and then you and I'll just hold back for a second. All right, we're going to listen to Flint Hill special, Flat and Scruggs. And what you're going to hear, folks, is what Sonny was talking about, the use of those tuners. And these are not the tuners he was describing, but this will give you an idea of how the strings change in the middle of a song. And this is a real good example by Flat and Scruggs, Flint Hill special. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. All right, we were, and that was, Sonny, what I took the opportunity there, since we were talking about tuners and whatnot, was maybe the most recognizable use of tuners by Earl, and that was Flint Hill Special. So you and I were chatting, and the rest of the people were hearing Flint Hill Special, about 2.5 minutes of that, just so they knew where we were. Sometimes people want to know what we're talking about, and I assume a certain understanding, and sometimes I should spell out things a little bit more, but they've just heard Flint Hill Special, so now we all have a grasp on what the tuners are about.
Those are called D-tuners, by the way. D-Davis, D-tuners.
Yeah, D-tuners.
They tune the banjo from G, a standard G tuning, to a D-tune. The standard G tuning would be the first string to the fourth, would be D, D, G, and D again. And then when you run those strings down, I don't know what it is.
Oh, there you go.
It'd be D and then something else. I don't know what the next one would be. You run, take D and go down two steps. That's what it would be. And then and the third string would be from G to F sharp?
Yes, it's F sharp. It just has to sound. It just has to sound right. You don't have to know what it is. It just has to sound right.
You don't have to know. Never did know.
You know, I've heard you talk about and banjo. Maybe banjo players are the worst in the world. And I sometimes play that little cut where you're live at a festival talking about tuning a banjo. But I've also heard you talk about, you know, look, at some point you can tune so much. Sometimes you just got to start playing.
Well, you know what? Tuning becomes a habit. To tune on the stage, it becomes a habit. And I never did like that. I always hated that. I was just so, for a guy to stand up there and tune. And an audience, they get sick of that, I think, anyway. I would. If I was out there, watching, I'd get tired of that. But almost everybody does it now. They got those little electronic, tuners that they clamp on the banjo neck and they tune between every song like that, but I never did do that. We always played like 25 or 30, 35 minutes without stopping. We just went from one song to another, which doesn't give you time to tune.
Don't you think most people in the audience don't know that you might be like off of a tiny little fraction bit? They're just, as the whole song goes, I mean, there might be a few, but don't you think most people in the audience, I'm not talking about in the band or the musicians, but most people in the audience, they don't know if you're a hair off, don't you think? I mean, if you're really off a note or so, but if you're right pretty close, most people in the audience can't tell.
Well, the thing of it is, I read this somewhere, that the human ear can only hear 5 degrees on either side of a true note. Like, if you hit an A note, your ear can only hear 5 degrees on either side of it. So you can be out of tune 5 degrees and nobody can hear it. You can't even. But that tuner tunes it dead on.
Yeah.
But dead on. And if you will leave it alone, you can play a whole show. Most of the time you can play a whole show and it'll never show up. So. Anyway,
I think that's the case. I mean, and if you're standing right up there with it and you just want it to be perfect because you want to have the best show possible. And, I'm like you. I've seen people tune. And sometimes you just think, just somebody kick something off and it'll all come out okay.
Yeah. I tell you what I always did. If a string was just noticeably out of tune, between the nut and the, tuner, I would take my finger and just kind of push it down a little bit,
right,
and raise it up a shade. And if it was too high, I would just stretch it. Just pick it up, get the string between your thumb and index finger along about halfway up, and just pull on it a little bit. That'll stretch to get it in tune. I always did that instead of turning the tuner, so anyway.
Can you, when you were on stage, could you hear well enough to tune? I'm talking about, you know, long before there were the digital tuners where you look at them, but could you hear well enough when you step back to make that final tuning if you thought you were that far out?
If it was noticeably flat or sharp, yeah, I could hear that. But most of the time it wasn't. I never could understand what Lester Nerl, before they had tuners and things like that, what Lester Nerl tuned by, or Bill Monroe. When I worked with Bill, I always just tuned with the guitar. I never know how he tuned or what he tuned with. Bobby had a tuning fork, though.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You could hit and hold it up, and you could hear a.
That's right.
Whatever.
I forgot about the tuning forks. I could never, ever have used one of those. I, you know, I would just pick up a record and try to tune it with the record, and then hopefully it was. Then if you get with someone, you try to get in tune with them. But how, you know what, the Flat and Scruggs records, were they tuned up higher, those early things?
They tuned one note high. Instead of being tuned in G, they tuned their stuff to A flat. And I asked Earl about that one time, and he said their instruments just sounded so much better, which they did.
Yeah.
They did.
Interesting.
Well, hey, it's time to get out of here.
It's time to get out of here, but you know what I'm going to get out with is, I don't think we got to this last week with Bill when we were talking, and, I'm going to play your Big Ben tune. It'll be the last tune we kick off with today. How's that?
Oh, okay.
That'll be good. All right, man. Hey, listen, we'll chat about what we're going to do next week and just stay loose, and I'll be happy to talk to you again sometime. All right?
Same to you, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you, man. Bye.
Bye.